सोच विचार के साथ मेरा नाम नदीम उल हक है
और मेरा नाम अंजुम अल्ताफ है।
वेलकम टू सोच विचार। टुडे आई एम वेरी प्लीज्ड एंड ऑनर्ड टू इंट्रोड्यूस हिल्टन रूट टू यू। Hilton Root is a professor in public policy at George Mason University. He is the author of many books, such as Capital Collusion, The Key to the Asian Miracle, Alliance Curse, The Fountain of Privilege. He has written a number of books, contributed a large amount of journal articles, as you might expect. He's a professor in public policy at George Mason and now ready to move to the economics department. His last book was Dynamics Among Nations, Using Complexity Approach to Economics. This is a new approach that I've talked about in my book and that I like a lot and that I've recently become very enamored of, as has Hilton. Hilton is also working on a new book now, which is called Global Transitions in Economic History. And we're going to discuss this book today as well as complexity theory. So I hope you enjoy the conversation with Hilton. Welcome, Hilton, to Soch Bichar. Today we're going to discuss this new book of yours, the manuscript that you discussed the other day, that we discussed at GMU the other day, your book that's coming out. It's called Great Transitions in Economic History, Network Dynamics of Institutional Formation, Cultural Transformation, and the Coming Global Instability. That is a big title, and there's a lot of expectation of this book. So could you briefly, Hilton, just give us a... What is a headline item here? What are you trying to tell people?
Sure, Nadim, it's good to be here. And so the reason, the motivation for this book was it's part of questioning certainties that we held during the 20th century that don't seem to be standing the test of time. So we had developed as social scientists, political scientists, economists, sociologists, analytical capabilities that made many of the problems of globalization and world order seem manageable and understandable. But during the late 20th century, it appeared that we lived in a world where those models were close enough approximations to reality to be a useful guide for policy and forecasting.
Right. We were very optimistic that the world was growing well and that recessions were a thing of the past. Robert Lucas had pronounced that he had understood the trade cycle and we were able to get rid of it. Greenspan felt that the central banks were doing a great job. Then happened the 2008 crisis. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so exactly. We had no major global wars among the great powers. We looked at a world in which technological improvements seemed to be continuous, steadily rising wages, social mobility. But since 2001, it's become very clear that the world is less stable and predictable than we thought, and many developments that we thought we had under control, including the process of economic development and growth itself, were actually out of control. And we had a severe economic recession, not seen since the 1930s. We've had global terrorism striking in all parts of the world, including in the homeland of Western capitalism. So We the social scientists have started to doubt the models, particularly the notion that the world was a closed equilibrium system, and started to look elsewhere. And so this book is part of that looking elsewhere, and it looks increasingly towards complex adaptive systems, which have been explored in physics and have been noted to have self-organizing qualities or properties and that can veer into a critical condition in which cascades can happen. And these models that physicists have developed presume a non-equilibrium world, that is, that equilibrium is just a subset of a larger non-equilibrium environment. So these models now are increasingly interesting to biologists. And so my view is, if they can apply to living systems in biology, why not try to apply them to living systems in social organization?
So the big item in your book then is the application of complexity to the international development transitions, right? So what are the key transitions that you're looking at?
So what I decided to do was to use these frameworks to identify great transitions in political economy over the course of world history. And one of the elements that makes this research field exciting is that it enables us to ask questions that we might not necessarily be inclined to ask using more conventional frameworks. So we also are able to observe dynamics that were not readily observable by contemporaries living through these processes, such as the Industrial Revolution, and it enables us to draw inferences about the future. So the first grand transition that this book considers is the institutional transformation of dynastic lordship. So this is a system of clear rules for dynastic succession that emerged in Western Europe, in Russia, in China, and in Japan, but nowhere else. Now, what's interesting is that even though it arose in very diverse parts of the world, the system of dynastic lordship ended almost everywhere, with maybe the exception of Japan, in the second decade of the 20th century. Now, that's extremely interesting, that a system that had been so resilient over such a long period of time and that had emerged in two separate corners of the world should terminate at the same time. So obviously there's something going on at the macro level of global civilization that we didn't really pay much attention to. So the second major transition that this book looks at is the Industrial Revolution itself, and that's the more traditional perspective that people take on long-term historical change. They tend to see the Industrial Revolution as this big hockey stick where there's relatively stagnant growth over a period of 2,000 years, and then suddenly in the 18th century, it just shoots straight up. So my question is, what kind of phenomenon is this Industrial Revolution, and what parallels does it have in previous history? And since it's a Western world phenomenon, I look to the Western world, and my observation is that it's primarily a cultural transition. In other words, if there was not a cultural ethos that encouraged science and technological innovation, then probably this transition would not have occurred. And if there was not an administrative state structure that had developed and a European-wide civil society, these scientific and technological innovations would not have been sustained. So in the 18th century, there seems to be a coming together of culture, of state formation, and the creation of this so-called European-wide civil society. And it's at this very time that the Industrial Revolution breaks through. So I see it as a multi-level phenomenon. In other words, it can't just be understood in terms of technology, and it can't just be understood in terms of economic growth. It had to be, there was a clustering effect in which all of these systems became very critical at the same time, and they underwent this gigantic transformation. And it's this transformation sometimes observed in physical systems called self-organized criticality that produced a phase transition. Something extraordinary occurs, the components interact suddenly and directly, they all transition together. And this is really what I tried to explain, why this criticality affects the economic European system all at the same time.
Mm-hmm. And the third transition? So the first is the dynastic lordship, the second is the industrial revolution, and the third transition is what?
Yeah. So the third transition, and let me just say something mm-hmm. to precede that, is mm-hmm. that all of these transitions I look at mm-hmm. in contrast between China and Western Europe.
Okay.
So the third one concerns the formation of Western law. Mm-hmm. And this is perhaps the most directly concerning, this has maybe the richest implications for developing countries like Pakistan, which we can talk about later. So this formation of Western law was a confluence of Germanic customs and Roman codified system of laws. And it took a very long time to unfold. In other words, there were numerous legal systems and customs and laws at play at the same time, occupying the European cultural space. And there was an amalgamation that occurred, and there was a formation of a legal profession, particularly beginning in the 11th century. And they created this synthesis, which over time created a foundation to protect both the rights of the population against the rulers, something that was unique in this part of the world, and also that protected property rights and protected female inheritance. And all of these unique features are what people call the Western legal tradition.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So very interesting. So what you're saying is, let me just quickly summarize that. What you're saying is that basically you saw that the traditional models were kind of coming apart in the 2008 crisis. We had a sense of optimism before the 2008 crisis, and then after that, there's a kind of a feeling that we need a new way of looking at things. And you chose complexity as a tool, a newly emerging discipline about which we'll talk, that you chose this to discuss how. Basically, you're doing a meta-history type of thing. You're looking at history, long cycles in history, and you're saying, hey, there are three or four things that you see happening which have implications for the coming world as well as for the development world. And you look at the way Western law has emerged and the process by which it emerged, and you look at the way Western system of government, especially how the dynastic structure emerged that allowed continuity of government and continuity of systems and allowed this law to flourish within that, and then how that eventually led to the Industrial Revolution, which researchers and historians are still sort of trying to discover, and you got a new piece of the puzzle there. You're saying that it's because everything came together at a certain time. The Western law tradition started coming together, the whole system of succession, etc., the continuity, which started developing administrative structures, and then gave room to civil society to develop. And within that, you are contrasting the Eastern and the Western system through China and the Western countries to probably now look at how the emerging rivalry between China and the US is emerging. So it's a very interesting construct. But let me take you back a little bit. Please explain what complexity is. I've tried to do that before in the podcast too, but it's such a new subject that it deserves a lot of discussion. So Hilton, please, I know you don't have a whiteboard or anything before you, no PowerPoint. How can you verbally describe complexity and the tools that you're using?
So basically what I try to do is in this book is not to look at the complete canon of research that has been undertaken in the name of complex adaptive systems, mm-hmm. and really to focus on those characteristics that are essential in order to understand the economy as an organized complexity. And this notion was already prevalent in the ideas of the economist Hayek. Mm-hmm. And basically, the insight or the focus shifts from the inherent characteristics of particular systems and looks at the manner in which individual elements are connected with each other. So it's the connectivity that becomes the focal point. And it's the relationships and the feedbacks within the different components of the system that now become the focal point of analysis. So that's a very different instead of looking at the transaction as the focal point, you now look at the relationships within the society that give rise to a particular transaction. And when we do that, the presumption of equilibria is not necessarily helpful, because we have to understand that agents are constantly assessing and reassessing their actions in response to the increasing complex behavior of others, and that in so doing, they create and transform the world that they co-inhabit. Now, interestingly enough, Keynes was one of the first economists to really discuss the so-called effects of perceptions on economic behavior. And of course, he was inclined to believe that this can give rise to irrational behavior. And that insight has been developed to a certain extent, but not to it's not as completely as it would have evolved in the complexity literature. So the second component of the complexity literature that I developed in this book, and many others are working on it, is the cognition processes of the agents. So they're no longer just completely rational agents. They're agents who are responding to other agents and forming their vision of the world based on their anticipation of what other agents will do. So it's these two components that come together. The cognitive framework, which is different from the traditional conventional models, and the notion that what we really want to study are the interactive effects, the relationships, and that, of course, leads us to the phrase networks. So complex systems are networks of networks, and they can be represented as networks, and in so doing, this enables us to see the historical change processes in a clarity and with a perspective that we didn't previously possess.
So basically, what you're saying is that complexity allows you to take a systemic view rather than the way we do traditional economics, is to use individuals as a unit of analysis and aggregate across individuals and then try and come up with some general propositions. But you're taking the system as a whole, so you're approaching it from above rather than from below, and you're taking the system as a whole and you're looking at the various relationships between the actors. You're more interested in the networks that actors form and their own cognitive biases or the cognition processes that they develop as a society, as a people, and you explore the interactions of the networks and the cognition frameworks and the feedback effects that arise from there, and that is the system of analysis that you put up. Is that a good way to summarize that?
That's exactly correct. So, okay. I concentrate on five characteristics. One is that these systems exhibit an order of many subsystems. And two, that the properties of a system are not readily determined by adding up the sum of all their parts. So there's emergence, and emergence becomes a critical element that we want to understand. Third, they're open systems, which means that they can't be separated from their environment. Fourth, they have evolutionary dynamics, which means they evolve intermittently and spurts and starts. And this is in conflict with many efforts of economic models to show smooth consumption patterns and to make lots of things smooth that are in fact spurts and starts. And understanding what causes those spurts and starts is actually very fundamental to getting the analysis right. And then as you noted, all of these changes occur in the context of networks. So complex systems are networks of networks. Mm-hmm. So each one of these generalizations takes us, I think, into some new territories in the analysis of economic change and developmental processing.
Fascinating. So basically, emergence, now with the term that you used, emergence, needs a bit of explanation. What you're saying is that something emerges out of the system that is unanticipated, or is it anticipated? I like the way you described economic dynamics. You're absolutely right. We deal with smooth dynamics. We have a model, let's say, of economic growth, where we can talk the Solow model, the Lucas model, whichever. But the idea there is that we have a model of an agent, a rational but representative agent, who maximizes his welfare over time, and that welfare is maximized in a certain framework that smoothly passes through time. And we aggregate across individuals, and we say that is economic growth. But you're saying here it's something different. It's emergence. Please explain emergence.
So the implications of emergence is one, non-linearity. Mm-hmm. So this means that the outcome is not the additive sum of all the parts, but it has a quality that in which some people would express the whole is greater than the sum of its parts, or the whole is not an additive or cumulative weighting or of all of the parts.
So it's not the sum of the growth of individual welfares, as in the Lucas or the Solow model or the Haradomar model, right? This is something else.
It cannot be stood through linear models and linear mathematics. Mm-hmm. And this is, of course, what makes it so conceptually challenging, mm-hmm. is that it involves a form of nonlinear mathematics, mm-hmm. for which we don't have a tool equivalent to, let's say, calculus or the physical world. And it's because we don't have that calculus tool, that mathematical tool, that it becomes problematic methodologically to agree on what the what complexity economists should actually be doing, and so it also means that the descriptions that we have of reality require looking at a handful of variables and don't reflect simply the properties of individual molecules or individual components. They have to do with collective statistical properties of the system as a whole. And in this regard, one of the other fundamental insights is that complex systems have a macro structure that is distinct from the microstructure. And I found that this idea is very liberating. Once you start to think about the fact that an economy or society or social system has a macro structure that can't be determined by the additive sum of all of the component parts, then you're really starting to think about this, a fundamental quality of systems that we haven't really thought of much in conventional analysis.
Now, you also mentioned something about open systems. I take it this is different from what we normally talk about openness of a country. When we say open out your trade system, open out to globalization, you mean something different by open systems, don't you?
Yes. Openness has many definitions in economics. Mm-hmm. But in complex systems, are open in the sense that the fitness or functionality, mm-hmm. of components cannot be separated from their environment. Mm-hmm. In this sense, it's as in a living ecology. We do not have an optimal species, mm-hmm. nor do we have, when we think about an open system, we can't really have an optimal solution to any particular problem. We don't have an optimal species in biology to which all other species should aspire. Hmm. So this tells us, if you do the analogy, that the fitness of any particular institution, like that of a species, is determined by its relationship with its environment. Hmm. And so therefore, if we're going to look at economic policy reform, we can't be looking at it in terms of optimal or best practices. We have to be looking at it in terms of adaptiveness within a larger ecological context and how different countries or species or firms in an economy would choose to interact and to adapt is based on their relationships in their immediate environment, not necessarily to the market itself as a general matrix, but in relationship to a more locally determined environment. And this is when you start to think about the importance of local ownership. But this gives you a kind of philosophical framework in which to understand why local adaptiveness is critical to the durability of the larger ecology.
Okay. Now tell me, you place a lot of, as you yourself just described your methodology, you place a lot of emphasis on networks and how these networks affected many things from the development of the law to the development of disruptive innovation. Now just explain to me, how do you use networks and what are these networks we are talking about and how do we understand these networks in terms of these great transitions?
So this is really the key methodological breakthrough that enables us to do the kind of analysis that this book indicates or points to, and that is the notion that complex systems are dynamic networks of interaction, and they can be represented through the use of network analysis, which gives us a formalism in which we can see the components as depicted as a graph of vertices connected by edges. So this is what is often known as graph theory. So this enables us to draw or represent the network structure with a great deal of fidelity. We can identify some of the core relationships and the ones that so network theory is essentially focuses on pairs of entities. And what this book does is it looks at those pairs of relationships that have a multiplex structure and are part of a larger network, such as a market or a state. A key insight of network analysis is that the network has a topography, and the topography means essentially an organization and a structure that influences the patterns of the transmission of information. In other words, the topography of the network itself influences the behavior of the network. And this enables us to look at the different kinds of network topologies that exist and ask how the transmission of information within that topology would give us different kinds of uncertainty, different kinds of robustness, different levels of tendencies towards self-organizing criticality. And all of these can be depicted very, very accurately using network theory. So this is a tremendous tool to look at change processes in human society.
Mm-hmm. So now, the way I read your book, it seems, what you're saying is that that basically Europe, because it had a network structure of dynasties, which was very peculiar because it spanned the entire European set of countries. It's not as if those countries were one empire. They were independent countries and there were a large number of countries. But there was a small set of families which were interlinked, which were like cousins or whatever, who ruled most countries in Europe. China, on the other hand, had a single kingdom, unified country, had made much technical progress before Europe. But Europe somehow managed to go past China in the latter half of the last millennium and overtake it to create the Industrial Revolution. And you attribute this to the network structure of Europe, the European dynasties and other network structures, as well as the European, the rise of the legal system from within those network structures. Can you give it a little more structure and tell us how to look at it?
Yeah, so you, what you've said is exactly correct. The differences of the network structure of China and the West, and that, when I say difference of network structure, I'm referring to what we would call network topology or network motifs, that these give rise to different kinds of behavior. So in China, there's a deliberate design that is aimed at minimizing the number of connections that information has to travel to get to the center being the empire, the emperor, and then which is an imperial dynasty. And so in Europe, there are also long links between local communities and hubs, but there's not a single hub that from which all the traffic moves towards. Europe evolved in a more organic way with much redundancy in the patterns of connectivity, and you mentioned this network of families that the book traces, so that over time there are several hubs, and they're scattered across a grid instead of there being a centrally located one. And we can measure the degree distribution and the centrality of each hub. That's what network analysis and analysis do, and we can see that these distributions shift and change, and in some cases, major houses even get deleted from the system, and other ones that were minor become major. But the system itself retains its resilience. It doesn't collapse. So you have 1,000 years of relatively continuous progressive growth within the system, with, you know, punctuated by wars and conflicts, but none of these conflicts are sufficient to undermine this network of families at the top that give symmetry to the whole development process of Europe. And China is quite different. In China, what some people might call the failure mode is such that the system can be destroyed and that's because if you delete the central hub, the system disintegrates, the parts are disrupted, and there's a great deal of disconnection. And then it takes a much longer period of time. Sometimes in Chinese history, there are 150-year periods of disorder between the dynasties. And during those periods of disorder, the synchronization that might have been going on that leads to growing sophistication of the economy, that comes to a halt, and then it has to be restarted with each dynasty. So in China, you get this cyclical pattern where the dynasty is very stable at some point in time, and then it becomes less stable until it goes through this failure mode. And as a result, there's a failure to scale up, to have these self-organizing critical moments with network significantly rewires itself without destroying itself.
But Professor, let me ask you a question. Tell me, are you kind of presenting us another way of looking at what Hayek said, that decentralization pays and centralization kind of is self-limiting or self-inhibiting? Is that another way of looking at it?
Yeah, so I think Hayek's instincts, and many economists have actually emphasized this point about decentralization versus centralization. So what network theory allows us to do is to take that generalization, it doesn't originate with network theory, and actually to look at what are the mechanics of a particular mechanism that endow it with resilience. Why are decentralized systems more organic and more resilient, and also why does nature construct itself in a decentralized rather than centralized manner? So it enables us to have a tool to actually explore this very, very fundamental insight about the difference between decentralized and centralized systems, we could find in Hayek and others.
But if that's the case, then tell me, then I suppose you do agree, but I think your book doesn't, with the conclusion of people like Acemoglu and Why Nations Fail and many other authors who seem to think that China's centralization will again lead to the collapse of China and that China will not get past a certain point. It's growing very fast, has grown at about roughly 10% for the last three decades. But that in terms of really catching up with the US and Europe, China will face some hiccups because it'll have to reorder its political system to be able to catch up. Do you buy that argument? But I think your book sort of kind of argues against it.
Yes, and you're exactly right. And this is a very, very excellent question. And so the difference between my view and that of Acemoglu's is that my contention is, and this is consistent once again with network theories, that as China grows and as China could potentially become the major economy in the world, the overall global structure in which both China and the U.S. relate to each other and also relate to subsidiary nodes in the system, that will also potentially change. So the change that China can bring into the network of global economics and can change the structure of the global system in such a way that it can dictate the terms by which the Western countries can mobilize and then may even make some of the core institutional structures of the West it may cause them to malfunction or to be maladaptive. Mm-hmm. So the thing to look at and the difference in the perspective is there's a larger system that co-evolves, and it may and the growth of China as a major hub in that system may cause the system to no longer have the characteristics in which a liberal institutional regime can be the dominant ethos of that system. Mm-hmm. And so this is the real crisis that may occur as a result of China's transition. Mm-hmm. And this is something that they don't acknowledge. They don't acknowledge that China is trying to create a system of alliances that will challenge the Western system of alliances and allow it to basically change the rules of the game globally so that it can better survive. And if it does succeed at doing that, of course, it will create an environment that will be more difficult for the traditional decentralized regimes to survive. It will create a great deal of uncertainty and stress for these systems. So it will create a major transition moment. And I don't make predictions about what the outcome would be because it is very possible that China will implode and not be able to succeed at its strategy. But now what's changed is China has an outward strategy. It's no longer internally consumed with reaching a certain level of prosperity. It's now very much concerned with its role in the world. And that will become even more apparent at the Congress that's being held in next month in China. The focal point will be, what is China's role in the world and how will this change the dynamics for the other countries, both emerging and already incumbent powers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the thought comes to mind that if we again sort of keep the complexity pattern in mind and taking off from what you said, China is kind of evolving its system slightly differently from the way Europe developed. And we are used to thinking of the European system of development exactly as you said, the networks and the various emerging traditions. Now, China is posing a new way of developing, which is kind of centralized within, but in certain sense, you also point that out in your book, that China's system is quite decentralized in certain ways, whereas it's centralized, but it's also fairly decentralized. But at the same time, China is trying to form this network of alliances to challenge a Western network of alliances, which is kind of the international system, which is currently dominated by the West through the UN and the international agencies. China is creating another set of system to challenge this existing incumbent process. Could China be thought of as a disruptor in the international system in some sense, and therefore a new order could emerge?
Well, that's certainly one of the implications. As China becomes a giant node in the system, the system will change in the same way that when the U.S. became a giant node system after its decisive influence in the outcome of World War I, that, in my opinion, made it very, very difficult for the monarchical system to revive itself. And it was a condition, actually, of the U.S. that the German monarchy dissolve itself. And that led to, in my opinion, a lot of the instability that re-erupted in World War II. In a similar sense, as China becomes a giant node in the international system from which it had been, where it had no role whatsoever in more than 150 years, that will change the properties of the larger system in ways that none of us can predict, in ways that could, in fact, be detrimental for China itself. But the Chinese have a long tradition of how to adapt itself to changes in its environment, and it feels that its system is sufficiently resilient that it could be the it could survive better the changes that will occur at a macro level than the Western systems. And there are already some signs of that, because the Western political systems right now, the party systems, are not capable of formulating policies that are sufficient to really guide these Western economies into this new stage of globalization. And so there is reason to doubt that, at least in the short to medium term, that the Western societies will have the capabilities, the institutional capabilities, to navigate this larger transition process. There, in many cases, they're not really aware of it. They seem to think that they can go back to a bipolar world where it's the West and China instead of it being the West and Russia. They don't understand that the global network system has become densified, and densification is a process that we can observe in network theory, where nodes have many, many more interconnections with other nodes, and they don't pass through they're not as dependent on a relationship with a single large hub as they were during the Cold War system. So this is a different global environment, a global environment where countries that have strong trade ties don't necessarily have strong defense ties and may operate independently in their diplomatic network. So there's no central control, and there's no the West position in the global network has changed. Now so is China, and China is now trying to figure all of this out. They are aware of the fact that there is a transition process going on, and we're not going to be able to go back to some of the assumptions of the past. Unfortunately, many of the Western political parties today are backward-looking and aspire to reconstruct both economic policies and social policies that were helpful or that were, let's say, suitably adaptive for a different moment in world economic history. So the book doesn't resolve this issue. It asks, where are we in globalization, in the history of globalization? And it suggests that we aren't where we used to be, and we're going to be in a new place. It's going to be a transition. We don't know what form that will take. It will be another major transition, just like the other four transitions that the book defines. Network theory will help us see some of the patterns as they emerge. we can only say that this transition process has just begun to get underway. And the critical, there are several critical aspects of it. It's not just that China has become a major giant hub, but it's also the other smaller hubs have more dense interactions with each other.
So Hilton, I mean, I'm thinking about it. I mean, it's fascinating, and it's a lot of, I mean, I think we could go on for 12 hours, but unfortunately time is short. So let me ask you, what does this mean for, let's say, a small country like Kenya, Tanzania, or even Pakistan, whatever? Okay, there's the network, European, EU, or whatever, US, I mean, NATO, that's a kind of a network that's operating. China is trying to form this network of which all of us becoming a part, like OBOR or CPEC or whatever. So these networks are forming. Yes, okay, we'll become a part of that network. But what does this tell us about our own problem? As you worked on Pakistan for a long time, you've contributed to many of our conferences, journals, etc. In Pakistan, we've got a fundamental problem of poverty, of youth unemployment. We're 100 million kids below the age of 20. And we need to find a way to grow our society, to have better employment prospects and better, social outcomes. Otherwise, we have a growing threat of terrorism, which too is a kind of network operating. So what does your analysis say to, let's say, a policymaker like I was in my country? How can I learn from it and apply something in my country?
Well, I would say that one wouldn't really aspire to be a policymaker in an environment that is so difficult, that is a vortex of all of these changes that are occurring and require an agility in the local response that's almost it requires. Major local transformation. So, for example, if you asked about Pakistan, now Pakistan is one of the countries that I've found most interesting because it is very much caught up in this China and Western world dynamic, and it's also caught up in its own transition process because there are local communities within Pakistan that have fundamentally different moral codes and different laws, the Sharia law, I didn't pronounce it properly, the efforts to create a Westminster-like constitutional structure on top of and to both bring in secular law at the same time that local custom is resurgent. Much of this reminds me of Europe at its formative stage, when there was this process that eventually resulted in an amalgamation between Germanic law, canon law, urban law, and Roman law. All of it came together, and it came together largely because of the development of a very highly skilled legal community at a certain degree of autonomy. And eventually became a very very capable of resolving these conflicts that are both in the moral and judicial sphere of society at the same time. Now, Pakistan is in a state right now where it's beginning to do this, and it does have the potential to have an independent legal community. It has a highly skilled lawyers that have played are playing a major role in the transition process, and as we've seen in bringing the head of state to account, this is a fundamental indication that something very significant is going on. And so, I find Pakistan one of the most interesting countries to watch. And as you know, I've been going regularly. And we'll continue to go there.
But tell me, would you agree, for example, that look? What your theory is saying, and this is something that you might recall I tried to put in practice when I did the competitive grants program and you were a part of it, should we try and, as a matter of policy, create networks of research and thought to help us kind of create disruptive ideas or new technology or new ways of organizing society or new ways of thinking. Is that one implication of what you were researching?
Well, I think that the network has to connect internationally. Mm-hmm. Also has to connect domestically into the areas that are currently, right. My observation is inaccessible.
Okay.
So for example, when I've been to Pakistan on several occasions, I spoke at some of these religious universities. Mm-hmm. I met with some religious leaders in tribal areas and also in major cities. Mm-hmm. And I had very useful conversations with them. But I noticed that I was maybe one of the few Westerners that had ever sat down with them tried to understand, you know, what their objectives were and what their goals were. And I think much more of that has to be done. I think that there has to be much more effort at creating a unified system of law that is meaningfully related to the customs and beliefs of populations. Mm-hmm. And currently that dialogue doesn't seem to be going on. Mm-hmm. So I could be missing it because it may be going on at a level where it's not visible.
It's a difficult dialogue to happen, and you're right. But unfortunately, the problem is that we don't have any structures for making that dialogue happen. The question that comes to my mind when I hear you say that is that something that the government should be encouraging, developing structures for dialogue of the sort that you're talking about, or the kind of research that I'm talking about? Remember in the competitive grants program that we had, you also participated in that we had, we deliberately opened it up to the whole world. We deliberately opened it out, even the review process and even the submission process, everything was opened out to the whole world because we wanted our local academia to be interlinked with the global academia. Now, sort of combining the two, should the government set up such networks and such platforms for creating dialogue across all segments of society and across the globe?
Well, I think that the Pakistani government doesn't really have complete control over this process. Right. Maybe shouldn't even seek to have it. Right. There are activities that are going on and also sponsored by foreign governments like the Saudis, as you know, and the madrasas and the religious schools. There are many people whose access to the wider world is not through the government bureaucracy but through these religious networks. Mm. That are also somewhat global, as you said. They're networks, and some of their aspects are that they're connected to global terrorism. On the other hand, they do seek to have some moral authority that resonates with the desires of the populations that they lead, where the state has failed to provide access to basic systems of governance, of security, and of justice to these communities. So, in Pakistan, you have to really sit down with these groups. Okay. The development of civil society in Pakistan is actually very, very complex. I remember when I was in Karachi and looked at the sewer system that was run by the Khan Foundation, and basically providing sanitation to a large segment of the society without any regulation or with government. Mm-hmm. So this non-governmental sector is what needs to be somehow brought into this, and particularly in the regions. If not, the local leaders are going to have authority that stems from tribal concepts and tribal law. And so you're going to have, you know, a total incongruity between the local population's behavior and that of the elite or middle class population behavior. That's not a happy situation.
Right. Hilton, I think this has been a fascinating conversation and I've really enjoyed it. And I think there's a lot more to talk about, but I'm going to catch hold of you again. I'm not going to let you get away with just one podcast. I think there's a lot to learn from you, so we'll do that again. But before we go, I just want to ask you two more questions that I ask all my guests. One is, the use of complexity, for example. Would you recommend that Pakistani students take to it and you use it in their research? And if you do, would you suggest some ideas on what kind of research topics they could probably think of, you know, for their PhD theses, MA theses, whatever?
Well, as you know, we did have one student who did a
use Amar Malik. I've even done a podcast with him.
Yes, and of course he tried to look at a very important missing component of Pakistan's potential dynamism, which is which is urban dynamism, where you have creative urban clusters, and one of the characteristics of these clusters is toleration for diversity, and the way Pakistan's cities have emerged, and some of this is due to simply the transportation systems, the zoning systems, is that the degree of toleration needed to engender a critical cluster of creativity has been suppressed or hasn't been allowed to flourish. Mm-hmm. So yes, that topic, I think, is still fundamental. Pakistan cities aren't creative vortexes of action and of interaction. There is no place where the Pakistani potential for creativity locally can come together. So where you see Pakistanis coming together and excelling and being extraordinarily creative is outside of their own country.
Okay,
and that's certainly not that doesn't lead to a sustainable developmental environment. So that needs to be abetted. I know you're very concerned with how one might go about doing that. So I think there are, Pakistan is probably one of the richest areas for doing research in complexity and economic development and sociological development.
Great. Now, Hilton, in closing, my last question that I ask all my guests, recommend a book or a movie or whatever you like, something that, you know, I suspect most of my audience should be students and young thinkers, researchers. So what would you recommend that they should read, or, you know, even a website or whatever? It's up to you. Something that they can learn from.
Students everywhere today are, unfortunately, you're spending less time reading and a lot more time looking for, and their attention span is very limited. I mean, in terms of they don't sit down and read books.
Right.
So there is something called the Complexity Academy, which is a website that I hire, and they have a number of short but really well-done presentations on complexity. And one can access that, you know, from a computer anywhere.
Yeah.
I would say that's a great source.
Okay. Yeah. I use them a lot. You're absolutely right. That's a wonderful source. Hilton, thank you very much. This has been very good and very informative. Thank you for your participation. And as I said, this is not going to be the last time. We will do this again. You've got lots more work that you need to share with us and lots more to teach us. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Soch Bachar ke saath, mera naam Nadeem Ul Haq hai.
Aur mera naam Anjum Altaf hai.